Hello, welcome to another episode of The Station Station. I'm your host, Alan Wima. Before we start, I'm excited to share that we're hosting Rust Asia Conference 2025 on March 28th in Hong Kong. This is your chance to dive into the world of Rust in Asia and beyond. We've already got Tim McNamara, the author of Rust in Action, as our keynote speaker, and more speakers will be announced soon. Check out all the details at www.rustasiaconf.com. Now back to the episode.
Hello, everyone who is listening, hopefully, to this podcast. I'm here again, taking over the show from Alan, who's the real host. I just sometimes take it over a bit. And we have a guest here with us, a friend of mine. I hope I can say that because we have met many times and we share a lot of laughs. So it's Guillaume Gomez. Many of you who are listening, I'm pretty sure you have heard of him if you haven't met him yet, which would be strange because he presents in many conferences. So I'm sure you have bumped into him at some point, maybe if you don't remember. And he's into a lot of things, and he's also working on upstream Rust stuff, especially Rust docs, Rust docs. So when you see improvements in documentation, and if you have a keen eye, you would see that there's a lot of details to documentation. And if you look at a crate that has been released a long time ago, they would probably have old docs in on their docs.rs page. And if you compare it to the new ones, you will see a huge difference. So we don't notice it because there's a lot of improvements happening in this space, but they're happening in a small increments over time. You have Guillaume mainly to thank for it. Of course, not just Guillaume. I don't want to say that there are not a lot of other people involved, but he's certainly one of the main ones there. So thanks for that, Guillaume. And he has other projects too, and we will talk about them in this episode. So anyway, I did a bit of introduction, and I hope that I don't have to introduce myself because I've already been so many times on this podcast. Alan, you want to say a few things before Guillaume introduces himself?
So I guess the long story short is all three of us just magically happened to meet in Beijing at the GoSim conference. So the last episode I recorded was with Pete, who's the guy with the big beard working in, in automated driving, I believe, or with automotive, let's just say automation, or not automation. What do we call that? Automobiles, I guess. Yeah. Automotive. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. And suddenly I just remember being sitting down. I think I was sitting down or something, and then to see you casually strolling by, and I'm like, you do know I live in China, right? So why didn't you tell me you were coming? And you're like, oh, I thought you were in Singapore. Those are fighting words over here, to be honest. Yeah. But as I told you before, but it was this magic that we all, so I met you, and then you kept talking about Guillaume, and we were doing some searching about this guy, and apparently he's been writing cookbooks and was also the chef for one of the previous presidents. He's doing a lot of programming work, and so you mentioned he should come on the show, and so we finally made that happen. I was surprised that this worked out because he seemed quite nervous, which I'm not too sure why, but I guess this is your first time being on a podcast. Is that right, Guillaume?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, so that's kind of the story, right? And I haven't dug as much into Rust as Zeeshan and, of course, Guillaume has done. So that's why I'm kind of letting Zeeshan run the show for now, and I'll chime in here and there if I can. So, but I think now that you've given your introduction, and I've given my introduction about Guillaume, now Guillaume's introduction to give his own self-introduction.
Yeah, it would be nice.
I started coding in Rust back in 2013 when I was bored in Dublin doing management master degree. Soon after that...
Management master degree?
Yeah, I do have a... Wow. I was doing a management master degree in parallel of my computer degree. So,
cool. Yeah.
So I have both. I only use one, but... So yeah, in 2014, I started contributing on the Rust compiler itself. At the time, it was mostly on documentation and compiler errors. Then from that, I started to migrate on things like RustDoc and docs.rs. I was very beginning.
Just to interrupt, sorry, but how did you get to Rust? Like, I get it that you were bored, but how did that jump to Rust from everything else?
At the time, I knew someone who was very much into testing experimental languages and stuff like that. And I was writing a graphical engine in C++. I was a bit annoyed at a lot of things at C++, but also a big fan of it because I didn't know many languages. And when he talked to me about that brand new language, Rust, I started to learn it from the compiler source code and with a former friend help. So yeah, and when I discovered it, I never went back.
That's really hardcore, going straight to the compiler
code. Yeah, I mean, there was no book or anything.
True, yeah.
So when the GTK RS was started, at the time it was just the GTK crate, and we were making the bindings by hand. Then in 2015, I was back in Paris, still a student after my management master degree, but this time it was my computer master degree. So I was working part-time and doing my master degree in parallel. And in parallel of that, I was working on GTK RS. Mm-hmm. We created the GitHub organization and the things were starting to go well. I started to work more and more on the Rust compiler too. And from there, so many things. I think, yeah, finish my master degree, continue to work on many things, on sysinfo, on the fmod binding, geos, and many, many things. It's difficult to summarize at this point, but yeah, I just got more involved into the Rust ecosystem up to today. Yeah.
And cool, thanks. And just to back up like a bit, I know you that you're an avid Mac user. So I wonder how on earth you ended up on GTK RS, because that's like no Mac user like really gets into it as far as I can tell.
I got my first Mac in 2017.
Ah, okay.
So for a job, that's literally, I only have my one Mac. I coded on it for like 3 years, and then I got a new, better Linux machine and came back to Linux.
Ah, okay. I didn't know that. So, but you before that, you were on Linux when you got into GTK.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing you were using GNOME.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've always been using GNOME. Yeah.
And how did you really get into GTK? Like, because you were using GNOME and you wanted to improve it, or what was the story?
No, literally, it was part of my journey learning Rust. The person I knew who was actually the one who started the GNOME bindings in Rust wanted help, and it was a nice idea to work on it as well. So just gave a hand, and at some point.
You mean Sebastian, right?
No, Tong.
German. Okay.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting that it wasn't started by.
No, it wasn't started by me. No.
Yeah, actually, Sebastian is someone I would also love to get on this podcast because also does a lot of things, especially with GStreamer. But you're not that involved with GStreamer.
No. When I make changes on the GIR generator, we use description of the GNOME API to generate the GTK RS bindings, which allows us to keep up very easily. At least much more than when we used to generate everything by hand. So when I make changes to our generator, I upstream them to GStreamer, and I migrated some C examples into Rust to show how to use GStreamer RS and stuff like that. But beyond that, no, I don't know much about GStreamer.
Do you have like any applications that run on GTK RS? Or?
Yeah, I do. My process viewer, that's why I
process
created...
Viewer, yes. Yeah,
that's why I created the sysinfo in the first place. I really love the capacity to be able to see your computer usage in real time. We have that on Windows by default, on Linux a bit less. So I wanted my own application, and then I said, "Oh, why not provide this information for all platforms?" And here we go.
Just for the listeners, this is process viewer means like it's just like a task manager or something, right? It tells you how much CPU is being used for all the processes and how much RAM and all kinds of system resources usage. It shows you a real time, basically almost real time, right? Like it's not exactly real time, but
not exactly. Yeah, it's you need to make a diff between two points in time. So generally, you have real time usage, kind of up to 1 second. It's a bit strange computation.
Cool. And for that, you did this sysinfo crate, which is something I've been thinking of using, but I haven't really decided so far. Because as we discussed before, like Sysinfo Crate, basically for, again, for listeners, this is a crate that gives you basically the information. That's the back end of the process view. So it gives you all the information needed as a library. And as you can imagine, it can have many, many uses where you need any information from the system, like let's say about user, you have a user ID, you want to know what their name and stuff like that. So for that also you can use it. But the thing is, like, if you want to use it where you only needed specific information. So previously, at least, you were dragging a lot of API with you. So because Sysinfo has a lot of stuff in it. And now I think from what I understood, like, it's split a bit like into already features and stuff so that you can use your what you want to use and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's actually, I think it was you who brought the idea.
Yeah. I was pushing for it at least.
So yeah, basically, there are a lot of different aspects. Like, for example, for the processes and CPU usage is a part of what I call the system information. So you have the system feature, then you have the disk, the users, the network, and all that is split in features. So if you don't want something, you can just disable the feature and not have it.
Ah, okay. Well, that's really great. That reminds me actually of a topic that we should discuss. I've been asking also for async API, as you know. I've been saying that it should be just primarily async. But of course, I know about all the many of the issues. But what is your take, like, honest take on async? Like, I get the feeling that you're not that big a fan.
For async, for now in Rust, my big issue is what happens if something failed. What happens with your data? Mm-hmm. Is it free? Is it not? Where does it go?
You mean the async cancellation issue, right?
Yeah. Okay. But with async drop, that should be solved. So the next issue is that it requires to rewrite a big part of the crate. And although it works very well on Linux, mm-hmm. it doesn't provide anything for Windows, for example, because Windows is a system API and there is literally no way to go around that. It's a blocking API. So if it works on Linux, it doesn't work on other operating systems. So,
right. But isn't it, that's like workaroundable, right? Because there's APIs that are blocking, but and they don't have any async version. And you can use these, for example, in Tokyo, you have this spawn blocking. And also in small RS, we have this unblock, which does exactly the same thing. So that I think they launch a thread or something behind the scene and then you can, that basically turns a blocking thing into an async thing.
So yeah, basically you can spam them and say, yes, start this in the background and we'll see when we have the answer. The only issue with that for me is that it adds a lot of cost that is not necessary with the current API.
Right. But that also the thing is, like, it's only needed for a specific, like, as you said, in your case, it's only Windows, right? So I think, isn't it like, for me, if it would be my crate, at least I would be thinking like, hey, for Linux users, which is, I think it's most of your users, right? As far as I can tell.
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, it's hard to tell, right? That's another issue. But at least like for Linux and Mac users, it's not a problem. So
no, for Mac FreeBSD, I think only Linux, you read files, the others, you have to use the API. So it's only Linux who will benefit from the async migration.
Ah, okay. So that's what you mean. I got it wrong, I think. So you mean that on Windows and on Mac, the API is not blocking at all?
No, it is blocking.
Ah, it is blocking.
But and I mean as a system API, the one I call from Sysinfo. Okay. That's why I say that moving to async and run everything in background threads will be much more resources for the same result. So not really worth it.
And Mac would be like, because Mac is like Unix, right? So isn't all of this, isn't all of this like file descriptor, like, I mean, they also have file descriptors, right? And you can have this select on any kind of file descriptor.
No, it doesn't work like that. It's mostly based, it's a mix between a sys CTL and some system API. It's honestly, Mac is one of the weirdest APIs supported by Sysinfo.
Yeah, I was actually bitten by that. It was like, I have this app, Gemoji, which is an emoji picker, mostly for commits. Yeah, Guillaume is laughing because I've been pushing him to use that in his projects, but he's not convinced. So he's laughing at that. But the reason I mentioned it, not to push for it, but because I had this problem that Yeah, there was some weird issue with the terminal. Like it would launch, the UI would launch the GUI, and there would be some real garbage on the terminal. And I was like, what the hell is that? Like, and turns out after a lot of like discussion with multiple people that Mac has this weird thing that it treats the TTY, like the file descriptor that represents your terminal. You cannot select on it, like not select, but there is a specific call like select. I forgot which one is it. What is that call, syscall, that is very similar to select?
And EPOL?
EPOL, yeah. So the EPOL thing was not supporting a file descriptor if it's for this terminal file descriptor. For all others, it was supporting it fine. So what was happening was that thing was getting an error. And the crate that was making this call, it was not expecting that. So it was just getting like this garbage look. So yeah, long story short, I was bitten by this weirdness of Mac that you have an API that is supposed to work exactly the same way, but no, there was it's not the case. So yeah, I see what you mean.
No, I'm not surprised, yeah.
I think we can be a little bit controversial in the fact that he does not like Rust Analyzer, isn't that true?
Oh, yes.
It's not that I don't like it. It's just every time I use it, my computer reboots because I don't have enough RAM for that.
Yeah, but I think it's because you launch it for the Rust project itself. And that's
one of the only things I cut on most of the time. So yes.
So it's still not working for you, you're saying?
No, I didn't try in a long time now. I have to admit.
But I thought you made you try it in when we were in Beijing. Didn't you try it? No? Okay.
In Beijing, I basically didn't touch a computer for all my staying. So.
Wow. Okay. And I think you're using like Vim, right, or something?
I use Emacs and Sublime Text.
Okay. Because I was like using Vim for a long time. I tried so many IDEs in my life, and each time I would just feel trapped. And when I started doing Rust, this was the first time I tried with VS Code. Of course, with Vim bindings, and with Rust Analyzer, and it was the first time I was like, okay, this is something I can use. So I was really surprised when I had to convince you about using Rust Analyzer, because I think every single Rust user I have met, like they just use it, and they might use some other editors like these IDEs, the Rust Rover or something like that. There's also this IntelliSense, something I forgot, IntelliJ, sorry. So the people use different things, but they always use Rust Analyzer. And you were the only ones that I met who's a really deep, really like hardcore Rust guy. And doesn't use Rust Analyzer.
Baby steps. You know, I started using syntax highlighting only a few years ago. So
wow, that's really hardcore. Yeah, Alan, I think he dodged it. So we need more.
That's too bad. I mean, I still don't know enough about Guillaume to really say, you know, what's good, what's not good. But, you know, I would like to get a little bit more back to the GTK stuff, because there's always this, you know, like what UI framework should we use? I mean, Rust is still, of course, a relatively new language compared to what it usually gets compared to, which is C++. There's obviously so many different UI toolkits for that. And also, depending which platform you have, you have your choices, right? So what kind of steered you towards GTK? Because I also heard you were a Mac user, which typically is not really GTK per se.
Surprisingly, GTK works very well on Mac.
I don't remember often seeing GTK in the apps that I use. That's why I'm curious.
That's a good question. I don't really know because I don't use Mac much. So
typically, like the people, when they write apps, they either, you know, they target multiple platforms, which is usually doesn't work, which is very hard to make really well work well, or they just make it for Mac, right, as the primary target at least. So they wouldn't go for GTK if you're targeting Mac. Why would you go for GTK, right? But if you're primarily targeting Linux and then you want to also make it work for a Mac and Windows, then you would, GTK is a contender there. But yeah, otherwise and that's why you wouldn't probably use it, because most of the apps you probably use are Mac, targeted Mac primarily.
Yeah.
I wonder if Firefox is using the Mac provided UI library, or if they are using a GTK for it as well.
I think they, so at least for a long time, they were using GTK only on Linux.
On Linux, it says they're still using GTK, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But I'm not sure about if they're using for Mac or not. But it can be used as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I can confirm that. Yeah, process viewer works very nicely on Mac. So
nice. Didn't know about that. But have you tried any other UI frameworks, or you just?
Oh yeah, I was and I'm still is a big Qt fan.
Oh really?
Yeah, I actually knew GTK before I knew Qt, but even though I still find Qt so much easier to use than GTK. It's terrible for publicity for someone writing bindings for GTK, but yeah, I find the API of GTK much less good, but I think it's because C++ is just so perfect for that. You just inherit the class, you implement whatever you need, and that's it, you're done. Right. GTK could provide that, and the work is in progress in GTK RS for that, but not moving very fast as we are all focused mainly on other things.
Yeah. I find it hard to use Qt. Is it Qt or Qt? Qt.
Qt. Qt, right? I think that
Because it's called Qt, I find it hard to use it just because the name. It feels weird to say, I'm using Qt. Just saying the word Qt makes me feel like strange.
If it's the only reason, I suppose it's fine.
The interesting thing is that talking of Qt and C++, so I've been at my work, I've been trying to interface with a C++ API recently. And one of the challenges was to how to get it with Rust, right? And there is this CXS project from Google, right? And that's all about that. But it's the tutorial is very basic. It doesn't tell you much. So I was having a lot of problems. And the last problem I was having, I saw an email coming in about this This Week in Rust edition this week. And it mentioned a new release of Qt CXS, which is basically a using CXS to make Qt bindings for Rust. And it looks pretty nice, actually. And one of the cool thing that happened was that they were making use of one of these features that I needed and I didn't know how to use. And I learned at least two things from it that I was struggling with, and I got them solved on the same day that I was struggling it for a week. So I was really happy to get that announcement about this Qt CXS. And also, yeah, in general, I wanted to mention that it looks pretty nice. So if anyone is interested in Qt ones, that's I would recommend it, actually. But also there was another bindings. Another binding for Qt, more not Qt, what is this thing called?
The QML?
QML, yes. You know what I'm thinking. So there was a binding for QML, and the guy who was doing it, I think he was not on this chat, but his colleague was, Tobias was here. So they ultimately ended up doing their own thing, right? This Slint project, which is also pretty nice. And I think it's also provides C++ API, which is really neat. It's not just Rust, although it's written in Rust. At work, we are using that, actually. So another framework, which is pretty nice. And we just wanted to ask you if you have any opinions on all of them or just
sticking to a few. I only tried a few, so obviously GTK RS. I'm a big user of EGUI, the immediate mode rendering, because I write a small video game on the side because I find it fun with the Bevy graphical engine.
Nice.
It's crazy good. I love it. Very much appreciate talking with the people working there, which I meet often, Franz and Alice and all the others. Very nice guys.
Wait, so you're making a game as well?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that. See, you don't talk about your projects enough. You only talk about a few. So is it available? Is it public or?
Yeah, it's public. It's called the Rust Toy Game, and it doesn't have much for now. It's literally I'm using the sprites from Zelda Minish Cap on Game Boy Advance. Mm-hmm. And it's a fully random generated world, and you can go into buildings. Whoa. And
So it's an open world? It's an open world game? Wow.
Yeah.
And it's which engine did you say you use?
Bevy.
Bevy, yeah, cool, yeah.
Oh, Bevy is so awesome.
That's why you knew so much about Bevy.
Yes, because, I know very much about the Bevy, but it's also because I work with them a lot because they have very specific issues I solve often for them.
you mentioned they had a big issue with the binary size, right?
Yeah.
So how much is this binary size, at least for you? What? How's your binary size?
100 gigabytes in debug mode.
Oh my God. Yeah. And what about release?
It was like 50 megabytes.
50?
50.
50, wow. Okay, that's not a lot, but it's still getting there.
So, yeah, just the debug information, it's just crazy.
Well, I can see that. Like I think that's not as big a problem nowadays with the developer machines. Like, yeah, like easily like terabytes right nowadays, and all of us, right?
I have 500 gigabytes.
Wow, which machine is that? Which century is it from?
I mean, it's not that old. It's 2 years old, so yeah, it's fine.
Wow. Okay, 500. Like, I didn't know that people still do less than a terabyte. Yeah, but then I can see like why is it a problem? Like, is it like a SSD? Like, at least
it's
like,
SSD.
Good, good, good. Oh,
good.
I thought you were about to say it's like a spinning disk.
I still use some older computers with GD, but. Not the same speed. If I need to compile a Rust 50 times a day, yeah, no, I need an SSD.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So talking about the binary size, like, so you had this problem as well. Like, you have, so I'm guessing you have all these optimizations enabled, right? Like LTO, and then the typical ones for your release binaries, right?
No, and I enabled nothing.
Why
I wanted
not?
to work in the shittiest conditions possible, so I need optimization. If it works like very fluid and everything, when I don't enable any optimizations, and when I enable them, I know it will just work.
Right. But for the release mode, like you want users to compile with optimization, no?
Yeah, well, I mean, I only use the release build because I don't want to bloat my binary size, but I could make the debug build with removing the debug information and stuff. It's just I didn't bother to add the configuration in my cargo.toml file.
Mm-hmm. No, but I meant more like the release mode. So when you build the release mode binary,
yeah.
Does it have optimizations in any way?
Oh, yeah. Well, everything that release mode in Rust provides.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I have, that's something also I've been struggling with a lot with ZBus, because people keep complaining that its binary size is big. And I have no idea, like in a lot of things, I just have no control. Like, I think we talked about it on the Matrix channel recently, that it's like you have like async functions, async methods, they're always bloated. Like you just can't do much about that. So that's a bit annoying. I don't know if you have any input on that or you have any ideas.
You can cheat on unsecuring your async function by returning a future, so you don't have the internal async closure moving your data inside it.
Yeah,
that makes it smaller, but it's more code to write.
Yeah, but I don't really have closures even, like, and still it's like I see that it gets really big. The binary size.
Oh, no. As soon as you have an async function, you have an async closure automatically generated by the Rust compiler.
For sure. But that I cannot remove, right? So.
No. That's why I say, if you don't want this async closure, you need to remove the async function and replace it with a normal function returning a future.
Ah, that's what you mean. Okay, get it. Yeah, that's something that can be done. It's not going to be super hard, especially if I just... return like a boxed future, right? Like then I can use async, but put it in a box and then return the box, right?
I think, yeah. Sure. It's part of the things I needed to do at some point in my life.
Right. You also work on GCC, right? Like GCC's Rust backend.
Yeah.
How did that one get started? Is it purely because your employer was interested in that, or was there some other reason you got started with it?
It's because of Anthony, who wrote it. Anthony is a long time friend of mine. Mm-hmm. So when he said that he was writing a GCC backend, I was like, when it's advanced enough, I can give you a hand if you want.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up working on it.
Okay. For the listeners again, just a bit of a background information. So I met Guillaume in Mexico City, 2016.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. When we had our first GNOME Rust Hackfest. And that's where I met Guillaume. And I also met this Anthony person that Guillaume is mentioning, who's from Quebec. I can say that. And I hope he doesn't mind me telling where he's from. But so yeah, he's from Quebec, and he was also involved in GTKRS for a while. I think he's not there involved for a long time, right? Like, yeah, he's doing other things. But he had a very interesting idea and project, this Realm. I think that is still there, right? It's
still, yeah.
Yeah, people use it. I hear people randomly telling me, oh, I use Realm. I'm like, oh.
Didn't write the Realm version for GTK4, though. He only wrote the initial one, and then someone updated for GTK4, but is not in Verity 2.
And Realm is the Elm for GTK, basically.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool, actually, the project as well.
It's pretty interesting, yeah.
So I just wanted to tell folks, like, who these people are and what you're talking about. So GCC backend, you were talking about that.
Yeah.
So Anthony got you into it because he was interested. Why?
Because he wanted to learn how to write compilers. So he wrote a compiler, and when he wrote it, he realized that he could make Rust use GCC as a backend. So he said, like, oh, why not?
Okay. And that's how you got in, just because your friend asked you to look into it.
Yeah, basically, yeah. For him, I made the intrinsic translation between the LLVM intrinsics and the GCC ones. So it's automatically generated for the most part. Then I rewrote the whole build system of the GCC backend because it was in Bash, and at some point it drove me nuts. So I just rewrote everything in Rust. So now it's even compatible with the Rust build system, which is quite convenient. And I got involved into optimization of the two. So in Rust, when we generate a code for AST, the abstract syntax tree, we give to LLVM. We also add a lot of annotations to the code saying, you don't need to check this pointer. We know it's never null, because in Rust, almost never use the pointers, it's a reference and stuff. So it allows us to have a lot of optimization about aliasing and a lot of things. So we do that and implemented that for GCC, because in GCC, we don't use GCC directly. We use what's called the JCC JIT. So the libGCC JIT is called JIT for just in time, but it's actually not just in time. It's also AOT, so ahead of time, what we do with LLVM. So the only thing with that library is that, not many people were using it, and definitely not how we use it. So I needed to add a lot of things that we were missing, like support for attributes that we are using to get a lot of optimizations. And now I'm officially someone who can merge commits on GCC. But working on GCC is fun most of the time. When you have questions, it's generally much less fun.
There's definitely some interest in Rust being able to work with GCC. I know there's some people working with that. Is there really a big difference? Should people even look at this? Because I mean, LLVM already does quite a lot. People are doing a lot with it. I know that people also really like GCC. Should we actually have this so that Rust can be natively run with GCC instead of always with LLVM? Or is there just, you think there's no real gain or benefit for that?
Oh, there is a big gain. For example, someone is writing Rust program for Dreamcast using our GCC backend. That you can do with LLVM. GCC is very old compared to LLVM. So if you have some very esoteric targets, you don't have much choice but to use a GCC, because LLVM will never add support for them. And in some very rare cases, becoming more and more rare, GCC generates better binaries.
No. Cool.
Yeah, it's something we looked into.
Yeah, that might explain something to me. Like, I recently switched for some targets, at least, from LLVM to GCC, and the binary size was different. So I think in GCC case it was smaller, if I remember correctly. So that might explain it, right?
It's very, very possible, because they don't generate exactly the same assembly. I think at some point they will generate the same assembly, because there is, maybe not actually. I think it's all about what you decide to pick, because sometimes you can generate a better code, but it will require more assembly instructions. Mm. So it depends on what you want to benefit. Do you want us to have something smaller or something better? But it was something that, since I'm working on it, Huawei took an interest into the project and asked me, would it be interesting for us to use the GCC backend over the LLVM one? And I looked into some numbers and some people who wrote a report, a comparison between LLVM and GCC. And on some super calculator, HPC and stuff, it was 3% better when you're generating binaries with a GCC and nice. Compared to LLVM. And I'm talking not in terms of binary size, but in terms of performance. So 3% still is a lot. But,
quite good, yeah.
Yeah. And I was surprised by that. But I think in a few years, LLVM will now be faster than GCC. They are catching up really quickly.
Okay. So they will keep catching on to each other, and we will have the LLVM as default always.
From what I see, GCC is getting a lot less traction than LLVM. I think it's mostly because it's honestly quite difficult to interact with the GCC community. They're not very, let's say, open. Yeah. Compared to LLVM, yeah, the tools that you have to use to work on GCC are terrible. The first time I made a change in GCC, I ran the test to see what I fixed or broke, and literally half of the test broke, and I was like, what the fuck did I do? And then I realized that most of these tests were completely unrelated to my change, and they are just broken. No one is running those tests. There is no CI in GCC. It's only mailing test, and yeah, okay, looks good, we merge. And yeah, that's terrible. I don't know why they do that.
No. Yeah, that sounds horrible, actually. So GCC, I think we should stick to GCC for a bit. Because it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds pretty terrible, you know. When working with Linux, I also kind of hear this kind of, you know, it's hard to work with it. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of what you're talking about with GCC. But I think Linux are a little bit more open. It sounds like they're a little bit more open, but still not totally open to having new contributors. I mean, is GCC also like a bunch of older developers that have their own established ways or are not interested in kind of, I don't know how to say this in a way that can be maybe construed as not offensive, but, you know, like newer ideas, newer tooling, you know, newer ways of doing things? Or do you think, you know, what's kind of your opinion? Because it sounds like, you know, you said it's broken, right? You used that word broken. I don't mean to kind of call attention to you, but to me, it's more like a cry for help. Like, hey, we should probably, you know, do something other than just, you know, because how can anybody new join this kind of project and help out if, you know, the tests aren't being run and being taken seriously, and making one small change seems to cause a lot of damage downstream, right? Do you think that they're actually going to be open to having some changes to fix this, or do you think that as of right now and no foreseeable future, they're not going to, you know, try to make the development of GCC easier?
Difficult to answer because it's only my point of view with the few interactions I had. But
no, sure. Let's make that part clear. Like you're still a beginner in terms of committing code.
Oh yeah, I'm completely a beginner of GCC. Yeah.
But here's the thing though, because like I just want to bring this up too, because because this is in my mind. You know, with Linux, right? Linus has gone out recently talking about, you know, basically all the older guys are like 60, 70 years old or something like that. And they're going to be retiring. But then the same people who don't want to change things, they don't want more Rust in the ecosystem. But I'm not going to talk about that part because that's a whole can of worms, right? But, you know, I think bringing in new blood, new ideas can make things better. But if people are going to hold on to it and not open up for others, that's a problem, right? But you know, so, but anyways, I just want to go back to, like, if people are interested in contributing to GCC, you can give your perspective. Like, how do you feel about that? Let's just keep it narrow like that then.
Yeah, I think it's complicated because, for example, when you make a change in GCC, the commit needs to respect a very strict format, which is terrible. For each file and each function ID, the change removed, you need to add a message, but you have a very strong indent on that. So basically, your message can needs to be less than 80 colons, but still need to be after the function name or the file name. And that I spend non-negligible time every time on that. So it's quite bad. And came to to them on IRC, and I was like, yeah, but why do you do do you need that? It's not like you actually need that. Basically, they were strongly opposed to changing that, because like a few people may need to read exactly these changes because it might depend on them. But like, okay, sure. Another case I was thinking it was.
So your
I forgot.
What you were asking them to do was to change the format of the commits.
More like to relax the rules on the on this formatting, because it's super annoying. You actually need a tool to be able to generate that.
Right. I think I know what you're talking about, because I haven't seen it for a long time, because you know, I also have gray beard, so I used to work a lot with people who do this kind of stuff. So it's you're like, you have to like document every single file in the commit, and like they don't talk about atomic commits, but then they ask you to document each and every file what is changing there, right? That's what you're talking about, right?
Not in the source code, it's literally in the commit. For every file modified, to add the documentation, and then every item modified in this file, you need to add documentation. But again, it's in the limit of 80 columns, and you have indent before the name of the file or the function. Wow. So it very quickly becomes very annoying. And yeah, I was thinking at some point, because they have the are supposed to enforce a certain style of coding, but I realized that it's absolutely not respected. So I wrote a small tool to just generate the tooling and everything. I sent a pull, it fixed everything, and it was like millions of lines of code. So yeah, okay, sure. And then I realized that in some files, the hidden ASCII characters, zero, they have the ASCII character zero, not the number, the zero integer. Like and when I removed it, I discovered that it was used to tell the tools reading the GCC source code that from this point everything is on a different version of GCC.
Right.
Like why don't you just put a fucking comment for that? Why would you do that? It's terrible. Don't do that. And people were so adamant and so fired up about that. Like, yeah, no, it's like that, and it needs to stay like that. And don't tell us to change things. It's supposed to be this way. Yeah, okay.
No, I mean, I sort of get it. Like, it's like the thing is that they have been doing it for a long time, and they're used to like a very specific way of doing things. So I sort of also see it from their point of view. I think that it shouldn't be that strict, and I agree with you. But I also see their point of view. But also, like on that subject, like it happens that sometimes it is just like this, and you have to accept it. And either you accept how the project runs, or you fork it, or you create your own thing from scratch, which is what happened to me, right? Like with this Dbus stuff. So there was a project I tried to contribute, and there were a few things that got me really annoyed. Like for example, the approach about tests. Like there were no tests, there was no CI. And I was told that CIs are basically useless in the author's opinion. So I was like, okay, that's something like completely opposite of what I think. So I think I need to create my own thing. So it just happens sometimes. Like maybe like they had like reasons for what they believe in, right? And that's a different way of thinking. And there's a point to it, of course. I can see that. But then if you're not agreeing to it, you have to just either accept or find your own way.
Yeah, and sadly, I can't fork GCC. And I will certainly not die on that hill. I mean, if they want to keep that, well, good for them. I was trying to help. You're welcome. Bye.
Maybe you can add emojis to the comments, and they will be less strict. Than,
right? Yeah, no, they will just become crazy if I start using emoji on that.
No, I'm just kind of curious, like, Guillaume, what have you been working on these days, right? Because it seems like you've been contributing and working on many different things, but what's been taking your attention these days?
In the last 2 weeks, it was mostly catching up on my backlog on the ResDoc, MDBook, and Clipit. My grand effort, I'm hoping to come to a conclusion sometime soon, is to make the whole all of the REST websites like docs.rs, ResDoc, MDBook, and Clippy Lint's page are now working without JavaScript. It can completely work if your browser is disabling JavaScript for whatever reason. And for accessibility reason too, it's completely okay. But there is one big missing is crits.io. And I'd love at some point to be able to make it work without JavaScript, but I need to convince Tobias, the team leader. So we'll see if that goes.
How can you do like things like, because I'm out of web stuff, right? Mostly, so especially front end. How do you like do search without JavaScript? Right? Doesn't it require?
No, it depends on how your search is working. For example, on RustDoc, you can't, because it's all provided. RustDoc cannot, it doesn't work with a server, so you can't make it work without it. But on crates.io and even docs.rs, because docs.rs is using crates.io in backend to generate its search queries, you have a server. So you simply send the request to the server, and the server gives you a new web page with the results. So crates.io absolutely doesn't need JavaScript except for a few things like displaying the graphs. But that's it. I think people can live without the graph. I mean, I will keep them because it's nice to have them. But if people disable JavaScript, they can definitely live without the graphs.
And where did you like learn all that web stuff? Like, was it like, were you doing it JavaScript something before?
No. I studied system development, and I never did system development as part of my job. My first job was a security engineer. I was working on providing a very restricted Debian for some clients. Then I moved to the data storage company, where I was writing a tool to fix CI merge queue and stuff, because it was not great, and I got annoyed at some point that it was not working, so I wrote a tool for that. Then I moved to another company where I was a full stack engineer. But at that point, I was already doing a lot of JavaScript, HTML stuff, because RustDoc, when I arrived in Rust for the first time, was, let's say, good, but not up to what it's currently, and definitely not what it will be in the next years. So I simply started learning HTML and JavaScript to improve RustDoc and docs.rs and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Before we conclude, I can give you a chance, Guillaume, if you want to say something to the listeners, tips, advice, non-advice, whatever you want to share. Here's your chance.
Yeah, sure. Write documentation is so cool.
That's true. Anything else?
Yeah, I can continue with that. If you don't write a documentation for others, write documentation for your future you.
Yeah, but the future you is someone else, right? Like you don't consider that person you.
Okay, that's maybe a bit too philosophical. Well, I think it's how you pronounce this word. Philosophical, yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess with that we can conclude this episode. I hope the viewers enjoyed this episode and listening to us babbling about things a bit. Thank you, Alan, for making it possible to this episode, and thank you, Guillaume, for your time from your.
Thank you for having me.
Extremely busy day. And we need to talk about your game later. I want to play your
game. Right.
Yeah. Maybe we should have a link to the download so your users can fill you with bug reports, since you like to talk about others having bugs and problems. We'll bring you some problems then.
Oh boy, the game is so not ready.
Well,
don't worry, we have beta testers ready for you.
Yeah, you're playing
for that. I need the old gameplay stuff to be there. It's definitely not ready. I do that when I have time.
Yeah, you do have tests, right?
On my game? Oh boy, no.
Okay.
I don't even know how you can test a video game automatically. By the way,
there are ways. I think there's like
there's ways. So you use automated drivers, but then you can also, you know. I mean, if you separate your logic from your UI, it's kind of connected. I think that I'm not a game developer, but I'm just guessing you can probably, you know, do a lot of unit testing, you know, data comes in, response comes out.
So I did once, like for one of my UIs, GNOME boxes, some automated tests. Sorry, listeners, we were concluding, but now this is very interesting, and I hope you're interested too. But we were using something called Behave, which was like using the accessibility layer of GTK to drive, like to push buttons and to do all kind of these kind of things, like to drive the UI basically. And then this testing framework, I forgot the name of it. Yeah, this, it was called Behave, and Behave was using something else. And that was just using accessibility. So if you're, as far as I know, yeah, actually I know for sure, Baby has accessibility because of this accessibility kit, or what is called access kit. So I think you might be able to use the same trick to drive the UI automatically. So just something to have a look at if you want to have automated tests for a game, and if our listeners want to have that. So have a look into that, I would say.
Yeah, I will likely take a look, but like I said, game doesn't have all mechanics yet, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But you write your test before you add the mechanics, right? So
you attest to ensure the mechanic is working as expected. So you, if you don't have the mechanics, there is no point in adding a test.
Yeah, true. Okay. With that, we can conclude now. thank you, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Guillaume, again, for coming.
And thanks for having me. Yeah.